from the scratchy studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another preventative hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. If you're thinking that I might be obsessed with learning more about a homeopathic poison ivy prevention product, well, you're right. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal what I've recently learned about this possible breakthrough that's been around for 150 years. Plus, a heap and helping of your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and tantalizingly taught transmogrifications. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up, like you no longer fearing Leaves of Three.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Weapons and antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the buzzing studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another blood-sucking hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we recount a cautionary tale that appeared in the July 18th edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer, written by Wendy Rutterman. Before we begin, I have to mention that the site of this story, Pennypack Park, is located about 3 miles from my childhood home. It was the only green area anywhere near us, and we spent many summer days there looking for eels and salamanders. Hey, 3 miles was not a long walk or bike ride for a kid in the late 50s, taking me to the most likely place I would be bitten by mosquitoes. And now, back to our story. Quote, Philadelphia health officials are cautioning residents to protect themselves against West Nile virus after detecting the disease in mosquitoes near Pennypack Park in the city's northeast section. The city's Department of Public Health routinely conducts surveillance for the virus. Recent testing has detected the season's first infected mosquitoes in northeast Philadelphia, prompting a citywide health advisory to area medical providers warning of an increased risk of West Nile. Health officials have instructed medical providers to look out for virus symptoms in patients from now through the end of October or the first frost. Patients with unexplained neurological problems must be tested. The majority of people bitten by a West Nile-infected mosquito don't get the virus or experience any symptoms, and fewer than 1% will develop severe disease, explains Emily Kehoe, the city's vector-borne disease surveillance coordinator. In rare cases, however, people can become ill, and about 10% of those people with severe cases die. The virus can cause encephalitis or meningitis, which result in the swelling of the brain and the membranes around the brain and spinal cord. Older adults and those with weakened immune systems are at highest risk. About 20% of the people bitten will develop a flu-like illness with a fever, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Other symptoms include rash, headache, fatigue, joint pain, and body aches. There is no vaccine and no specific treatment. Rest, fluids, and pain medication can help relieve the symptoms. Most people fully recover. In Philadelphia, between 4 and 9 people have been diagnosed with West Nile virus that caused neurological complications every year, and at least one case was fatal. As of now, there are no confirmed cases of West Nile virus among Philadelphia residents this year. Every year, mosquitoes infected with West Nile virus are detected in parks citywide. My Pennypack Park, which includes about 1,600 acres of woodlands, meadows, and wetlands in northeast Philadelphia, accounts for a lot of those sightings. McGrath here. Mosquitoes should not be able to harm you if all exposed areas of your skin have been fully covered with a commercial spray or liquid whose active ingredient is oil of lemon eucalyptus, a natural plant-based compound found to be as effective as high concentrations of DEET, which is a highly toxic chemical repellent. And always dump any standing water near your home to prevent new mosquitoes from breeding.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we'll help you prevent poison ivy reactions. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Extension number 3. Debbie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. Now, where are you located?
I'm just outside Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, okay. Debbie, near Cincinnati, what can we do you for?
Well, I have a question about pests and controlling pests with other predatory pests. So I recently have put a couple of beehives in my garden, which means no chemicals and no even natural insect, you know, kind of repellents. And I've been reading that there's some bugs, like ladybugs eat aphids, wasps eat ants, but they're good predator bugs that you want in your garden. So I'm wondering if you can give me a little more information and maybe some great sources.
Okay. So beneficial insects is what we're talking about. The most common that people try is ladybugs. These are collected from their overwintering sites, and they've been collected almost forever, like 40 years. And it doesn't hurt their population one bit. A lot of times they'll just fly away when you release them. And that's because you have to have a system in place. You want to soak your garden. And this is the only time you get to soak your garden in the evening. You must soak your garden and wait until dusk. Then distribute the ladybugs actually onto the plants as close as you can to aphid-infested plants or, you know, big drops of water. If they have water and they see food, they're going to stay. They're not going to fly away. Most people who have a bad experience release them first thing in the morning into a dry garden. And, of course, they're going to book their way out of there. You know, they need moisture. They need food. They don't like the sun that much. The bigger aphid eater, or the one with the bigger appetite, is green lacewings. These are very diaphanous creatures, almost looking like fairies. They're beautiful. Look up a picture of a green lacewing and you'll just marvel. You know, we never get to see them like that because the photos are blown up 18 times, but they are remarkably beautiful. And their larva is called the aphid lion because these little alligator-like creatures devour the most aphids per hour of any other insect. And learn to recognize what the babies look like because both green lacewings and ladybugs, their little kids do not look anything like them. They actually look kind of scary, a little lobster-like, a little almost dragon-like. But that also makes them very distinctive. And those larvae are the ones that are going to eat the aphids for you. So it's important to recognize them. And it's easy to do. Once you see some pictures, they're very easy to spot and protect in your garden. And you get green lacewing eggs, kind of what we used to call mail order. And they send you a bunch of eggs pasted on a little piece of cardboard. And you put that in your garden as directed. And they emerge from the eggs and start chowing down before they turn into green lacewings. So,
is it safe to have them shipped even now in the heat of summer?
Well, a responsible company, there's one called Arbico. I think it's A-R-B-I-C-O, out on the West Coast where I have visited and seen train cars filled with flies to provide food for the fly parasites they sell to farmers. My wife almost never forgave me for that one. But yes, any responsible company, the same way as with plants, will ship them at the correct time. It's been a long time. They may have even progressed to special packaging or something like that. But the buyer will tell you the best time to release them. The buyer. Great. You're the buyer. The seller.
I'm the buyer.
Dyslexia. Go away. Now, you sent us an email, right?
I did.
And you also mentioned buying praying mantises. And this is a very volatile topic. There are at least two Native American mantis, one called the Carolina mantis, and I forget the common name of the other one, but they are native. They've always been here. The quote problem is that people started importing the much larger Chinese mantis, which many people fear are competing with native manti for food and occasionally maybe using them for food because praying mantis fall outside the category of beneficial insects in that they are not specific to a certain pest. They're like dogs. They'll eat anything, good bugs and bad, including your bees. But I don't think you'd have a problem as long as you made sure you were getting sent Native American egg cases.
Is Arbico still a good company to source praying mantises from?
Well, I mean, they were around when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, and I still see them surface now and then. They're at the top of the food chain when it comes to breeding these things. And on their website, you'll find both predatory insects and beneficial insects. Of all kinds. There's a wide variety out there. There's the spined soldier bug. There's the wheel bug, which is easy to identify because it's got half a wheel on its back. There are parasites, little baby wasps that are very specific to infecting caterpillars and fly larvae. They lay their eggs inside, the eggs hatch inside the pest, and the babies grow up on that pest and then fly away, which is another important point, especially for tomato growers. If you see a tomato hornworm on your tomato plants and it has white spikes up and down its back, do not destroy that caterpillar. Those are the cocoons of beneficial micro wasps that will chow down on the insides of the caterpillar or the maggot and then fly out and reproduce. So the key with all these is to really recognize what you're dealing with. Predaceous ground beetles do a tremendous amount of work. And all you got to do is not kill them. And you have taken the first major step. You're not using any kind of pesticides in the garden. So that is a primer. But these things have been proven to be very effective, especially in greenhouses, but in the home garden as well. Just remember, all these creatures need a little bit of moisture, so you have to water your plants during dry spells just to get water to these small creatures. But when you do that, do it in the morning so it'll all dry off before evening sets. How's that?
That's great. Thank you. Anything that's particularly good at ants?
Ants?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you have to get to the colony's queen and knock her off. And then the workers, being all male, will just stumble around not knowing what to do without a woman telling them, and the colony will die off. And there are non-toxic ant baits out there containing boron, boric acid, sodium tetraborate, essentially some form of the element boron. And they put that inside a tasty kind of shell, and it's very slow acting, so the ants take it back to the nest. The queen eats it. Everybody's fine for the first couple of days. Then that first ant starts getting sick, and within a week, it has built up enough in all of their systems, including the queen, to kill them off.
Okay, great. Yeah, ant physiology and bee physiology are really similar, so you just have to be super careful.
No, not in this case. No, bees are not going to be interested in these little pellets.
Okay, perfect. Awesome.
All right.
You're so helpful. Thank you. Yes.
All right, good luck to you.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there to stop pruning for the season, because pruning stimulates new growth that may not have time to become hardy before frost. But don't go putting those pruners away just yet, because we'll be right back to take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden, from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to this service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610 694 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, we'll finish off my novel-length treatise on a homeopathic poison ivy preventative. But right now, it's time for something special. You ever wonder what it's like when I'm on the other side of the table being interviewed as opposed to interviewing others? Well, just recently, I was a guest on the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show, which is syndicated based out of Wisconsin. Here's that entire interview.
Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Mike McGrath is a radio show host and gardening guru. He answers tough and regular gardening questions for the masses. Welcome to the program, Mike.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, happy to have you. I'm glad you've taken time out of your busy schedule not only to educate Holly and myself, but all of our listeners.
All right, before we proceed, may I say that my radio show is You Bet Your Garden, which is what you do if you follow my advice, and it's an NPR syndicated show that's available across the country on terrestrial radio and podcasts all over the place, and you can find it at WDIY. For doityourself.org.
Well, how did you become a radio host? Where did that journey begin for you? And was your goal always to be about gardening, or did you fall into that?
Radio host, I was 17, graduated high school, went into Temple and chose communications, which was radio, TV, film at the time. I don't even know if Garrison Keillor was on the air, but I wanted to be the next Garrison Keillor. And I did most of my work on radio, and then in a weird way, I wound up being on TV almost as much as I was on radio. I had no gardening interest. I did not grow up with gardening. I grew up in a row home with concrete all around. The nearest park was 3 miles away. But when I was in my late 20s, I was thinking, you know, it's time for me to stop running around and look for, quote, the one. And I found her at a party. Oh, my God. It was like instant. It was like Hollywood. We locked eyes and that was it. And all she wanted was somebody who could move her out to the country and grow raspberries. And being totally infatuated, I said, I can do that. And I got home that night and called a friend of mine, Gordon Smith, a fabulous photographer who took the pictures for my coffee table book, Kitchen Garden A to Z, that was published by Abrams years ago. And he laughed and he laughed and said, you're so lucky, raspberries just grow themselves. And then it was off to the races.
Are you still with this wonderful woman?
She passed away from ALS in 2017, the worst thing that could ever happen to anybody, much less me.
But you had a wonderful life with her.
35 good years.
Very few people can say that nowadays. They've been with the same woman for that many years and loved her.
Oh, God. It was mutual. When we first decided to get married, we made an agreement that the relationship would be 60-60. Each person would give 10% more than normal. And that seemed to be a good way to work it.
Yeah. Well, whenever you got into the gardening and the radio talk, you've talked to a lot of people about a lot of mistakes that they've made in the garden. What have you found to be the most common mistake people make when trying to grow their vegetables, and what is the answer to correct that?
Well, the biggest mistake they use is chemical fertilizers. And especially I like to go on a rant against 10-10-10, which is promoted as a balanced fertilizer, except that there's no plant in the universe that wants equal amounts of N, P, and K. The perfect fertilizer would probably be around a 3-5-2 or something like that.
Right.
That would be balanced.
Yeah, we see, 10-10-10 or triple 20 or, whatever.
Oh God, triple 20, you might as well start throwing bombs into your garden, because that's what you're doing. I mean, you guys know these are all leftover explosives from World War II.
Right.
So you grow above ground potatoes. Can you tell us about that process and how one would go about doing the same?
It's really simple. If you look up online, the Lehigh compost bin, which was developed by the founder of organic gardening, J.I. Rodale, in association with engineers at Lehigh University, which is close to where Rodale was founded. And it's one of these things, I got to figure out how you explain this, but there's a slat, there's an opening, there's a slat, there's an opening, there's a slat, there's an opening. So you fill up the bottom, say, third with dirt, because you need the most space for growing at the lowest point. And then you plant your seed potatoes with the eye pointing out at the middle of each quadrant. So the greens, as they develop, will grow out the slat. And then you put in more dirt or compost, or my personal recommendation would be like 40% compost, 40% screened, high-quality topsoil, not junk, and 20% perlite to make it nice and light for the potatoes to grow easily in. And then when you get to the right height, you put in another run of potatoes, again, sticking them in the middle, right at the line where they go outside so the greenery can grow out there. And then you fill it all up to the top and you put four more potatoes I'm tempted to call them the corners, but obviously they're not the corners, they're the middles. And then I always like to plant one in the dead middle at top, then throw on more soil, and that one's for good luck.
I see. And I'm sure you've seen, and we've seen during the pandemic, there was a whole influx of new gardeners, and some of them have dwindled off. But what is the best advice you can give to a new gardener?
Talk to other gardeners. People who've been doing it for years and years, even if you have the room at home, your first year, get a plot in a community garden or a shared garden with a friend where you'll do half the work, and you'll be off and running. When I started as editor of Organic Gardening magazine in 1990, actually being known to the public, the information was all over the place. It was old wives' tales. It was stupid stuff like, plant potatoes in a hill. Excuse me. Potatoes are never supposed to be exposed to the sun. Planting them in a hill increases the odds dramatically of them being exposed to the sun. Why don't you plant them instead in nice, deep, loose, workable soil? And you won't keep getting those green potatoes that are toxic.
Right. And that's the thing. And it's kind of it made it even worse now with the internet, because back then you just kind of word of mouth in the 90s. Now these people, they put it on the internet because they want lots of clicks and revenue, and they'll say pretty much anything that they want to in order to get you to click on their video.
12 garden hacks that will grow you greater tomatoes. Uh-huh. And to me, that means there's 12 hacks writing. I mean, you know, people who don't know what they're talking about.
Right. Or like,
when I started back in 1990, everything was geared towards chemicals. There were very few organic advocates. In fact, surveys showed that most of organic readers use Miracle-Gro. And at one point, I got my revenge. About 3 years in as editor of Organic Gardening, Miracle-Gro started ads, which were technically true, the favorite fertilizer of organic gardenings. So I was in charge of the trademark of the word organic gardening, which J.I. Rodale had coined. And I called them out on it. The government got down on them. They had to stop the ads. And that's also the time where, like, I got up from my desk and went, okay, this is why I'm here.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So that's...
Oh, really, by the way, finishing up the potato thing, at the end of the season, you just lift the compost bin up, and then you sort through it. All the potatoes are above ground.
That's really cool method. So if someone feels the potting soil they have is not fertile enough and the plants are suffering, should they replace all of it next season? Anything they can do now to save it? This is actually a problem I'm kind of having, not with vegetables, but with some flowers on my porch.
I just did a question of the week on this, because what do you do with your old potting soil? I've been at this game for 30 years, so I have heirloom potting soil. And what I tell people to do, which is what I do myself, we were doing it today, is you empty out a bunch of your containers that have potting soil in them. You mix in some perlite, and then you mix in a good amount of compost and or worm castings, and then you use it again.
Okay.
So it's
easy peasy.
So if your potting soil is maybe questionable and you're realizing it mid season,
why is it questionable?
My sunflowers are just not doing well. I have some that I started from seed, I have some that reseeded, and then I have some that I just planted straight into the soil.
And they're in containers.
Yeah, they're in a big container.
In Wisconsin.
Right, yes.
So, I mean, you have a very short season that's miserable in the summer.
Right.
You know, Arctic in the winter. And it is challenging, although I have found that the more challenging the locale, the more intense gardeners are about it. But if you're growing them just in potting soil year after year, yeah, you're going to be using up the nutrients. A simple way around that is, especially if you make your own compost, because I have 8 different composting systems going, and I always have one that's finished, you can just top dress the containers with fresh compost, and every time it rains, your roots will get compost tea.
There you go. Well, Mike, we've really enjoyed the time we've had with you. How can people find you, find your show, and if they have questions, how can they get a hold of you?
If they have, if they simply type "You Bet Your Garden," all words, no funny stuff, into their search engine, they'll get a lot. I would also urge people to visit the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. where we post new stuff every day. We have dynamite conversations between gardeners, and I've actually used some of those conversations to spark a question of the week or an interview or something like that. And if you go to wdiy.org, because we're NPR, everything's an org, which stands for organic, by the way, you'll find me very easy. And the final thing I would say is the show's email is youbetyourgarden, all words spelled out in English, one@gmail.com. Do you know how hard it was to get a one?
It's a challenge to do a lot of things online that you want to have done correctly.
But a final word, gardeners out there, relax. Remember that, or know that farmers make a profit once they harvest 55% of the crop they planted. So you can't agonize over the losses. If you want perfection every year, take up woodworking, because gardening is not for you.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, we thank you so much for your time, your inspiration, and your knowledge. Thank you so much for that, sir.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there to absolutely avoid pruning any plants that bloom in the spring, because next year's flower buds are already formed, and pruning now would mean fewer flowers next year. But don't go apologizing to your ornamental cherry trees just yet, because we'll be right back with more about poison ivy prevention and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Have you been growing garlic for years, or do you want to begin growing the famous stinking rose? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the garlic timing and tricks you need to know, plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. And we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll help you prevent poison ivy reactions. You won't want to miss it. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Listen to the prompts and choose extension number 3. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
How you doing?
I am just ducky, as we say.
You stole my line. And where is Michael Ducky?
Albemarle, North Carolina.
Okay. What can we do you for, sir?
I had a garlic harvest that was less than satisfactory this year. They might have been the size of a quarter, And I was curious, could I just flip them immediately this fall, stick them back in the ground, and hope for a better yield through the winter?
Was this your first year?
It was the very first year I tried this.
Okay. And where did you get your planting stock?
A friend gave me some that he has specially designed through the years and cultivated.
Oh, excellent. There is no better way to do this than to start with garlic that's been growing locally already. So you did break the bulbs down into individual cloves, right?
I did.
When did you plant?
Late October, early November.
Yes. And that is almost entirely the cause of your problem. For many years, okay, people were told to plant garlic on Columbus Day, which was a supposedly lucky day. But research performed by the Garlic Growers Association of the Poconos absolutely proved that September plantings are going to give you much bigger bulbs. Think about it. I mean, I don't know how cold it gets where you are, but that gives them an extra month to develop good, solid roots before it gets cold, so they don't have to go into the winter with weak roots and really almost start all over again in the spring. So I've been planting my garlic cloves as close to, like, between September 1st and the 15th. And when did you harvest this year?
Just say July 1st.
Okay, that is absolutely normal. Now, by what measure did you decide it was time to harvest?
The stalks were dead. The whole area was kind of weeded up. It looked pitiful.
Really?
Yeah.
The entire stalk was dead?
Yes. And the bulbs were about quarter size, maybe half dollar size, which not optimal.
That's not bad. So I think planting early will solve all your problems. Whether you like it or not, you got to keep that bed weeded. One of the easiest things to do is suck up and shred lots of your fall leaves. And then when the plants emerge and you can see where they are, put 2 inches of shredded leaves in between them so that they will get nutrition every time it rains and they have a nice mulch on top of them. And the time to harvest is when 1/3 of the plants, each plant, has turned brown at the bottom, but is still green up top.
Oh, how does that work? It's brown at the bottom, but green up top?
Yeah, the garlic, as it matures and makes a full-size head, will start to furlough its leaves, so to speak, shutting off the lowest ones first and then progressing up the plant. And if the whole plant gets dead, you're not going to get good garlic. What you do is when you see a lot of your plants have the bottom third leaves brown, pull up a test bulb. If it looks like a leek, it's too early to pull. If it looks like a good head of garlic, it's time to start pulling the fattest stalks first to give the skinnies more time underground. Okay?
Okay. Got it.
That's it. It's easy peasy. It grows itself.
You make it sound super easy.
Well, I mean, nothing is easy the first time around. I always say this is like assembling a gas grill on your own. You buy it in the box, you bring it home, takes you all day to assemble it. You got parts left over, the wheels are shaky, but the next gas grill you buy in a box, you'll do a much better job in half the time. And by the time you've done it three times, you could be one of the kids in the store putting them together in the back room in like half an hour each. Experience, man.
I need more.
You're living the adventure.
Definitely.
The fact that you got usable garlic, that's a win. That's a W.
Well, I'll take it.
All right. Well, I think you're going to do better every year.
Thank you.
My pleasure. You take care, man.
Bye-bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, our poison ivy prevention update, which we are calling, Can You Prevent a Poison Ivy Reaction? Part 2. Or maybe it's part 3. I lost count. Anyway, to recap, on a recent show, Stephen from Missouri recounted that he had been a lineman for what was then the Bell Telephone Company, which required him to climb poison ivy-covered telephone poles. But the telephone company had supplied its linemen with something called immune ivy, a liquid that you mixed with water, took on a regular basis, that would eventually protect you from the dreaded allergenic oil, urushiol. He reports that while taking this liquid, he was able to climb poison ivy-covered poles without a reaction, and he wondered if it was still around. I couldn't find it under that name, but did discover a modern version, a homeopathic treatment called Oral Ivy, which is now distributed by Nature's Way under the name of the original maker, Boric and Taffel, which was located back in my hometown of Philadelphia. Beginning in 1915, the AMA campaigned against homeopathy so vigorously that the bottom dropped out of the American market. Quote, fortunately, the worldwide reputation that Boric and Taffel medicines had earned for purity, quality, and efficacy generated sufficient export business to enable the firm to survive in spite of greatly diminished United States sales. But homeopathy made a comeback in the 1980s and 90s when the idea of using alternative remedies swept the nation, and the Boric and Taffel Company was still around to make a comeback. The website, homepoint.org, from which I just quoted liberally, has a photo of the original Boric and Taffel product, which was simply named Ruse Tox, the homeopathic name for poison ivy. Undated, the bottle looks to be from around 1900. And Wikipedia has a very interesting, but also undated photo of FDA personnel, one of whom is clearly using a Geiger counter, inspecting a shipment of Boric and Taffel products. Based on their white shirts and skinny black ties, it seems to be from the early 60s. You can clearly see the name of the firm in their address, 10th and Arch Streets in Philadelphia, but there's no postal zone number, which would identify it as being pre-1963 or a zip code which came into effect in 1963. Those differences are a great help in dating things from the recent past. Well, come on, it's recent to me. I was already 12 years old when Mr. Zip appeared. In 2005, the pharmaceutical company that had kept the name alive closed its Santa Rosa manufacturing facilities and moved its distribution to Nature's Way in Utah and its manufacturing to the Netherlands and Mexico. The Boric and Taffel Oral Ivy distributed by Nature's Way is labeled as a 3X preparation, which means it goes through three ritualized dilutions. Many popular homeopathic preparations go through 20 or 30. And there are good medical studies showing that a small but detectable amount of the original full-strength ingredient can be found in dilutions of 2X and 3X. Now, I have to relate a story about Frank Buck, whose catchphrase was, "Bring 'em back alive," which is what he did as a live animal trapper and not a trophy hunter. Idolized as a true folk hero in the 20s through the 40s, Buck came close to being bitten by king cobras many times and decided to try and make himself immune. He milked a drop of venom into a large container of water and took a single drop from that in a glass of water. He nearly died, but he kept at it until he could take high doses without harm, supposedly becoming immune to one of the deadliest venoms on Earth. Knowingly or not, Buck had created a homeopathic treatment for snake bite and or used a technique akin to allergy shots to gain immunity. And that, as we wrote in recent questions of the week, explains how the Roustox Oral Ivy homeopathic product has a potentially valid scientific explanation. In fact, medical studies conducted over many decades against placebos have shown some homeopathic products to be very effective, especially against seasonal pollens and house dust. Simply put, homeopathic cures involve taking a single drop of a substance deemed responsible for a condition or of causing the condition at full strength, placing it in a gallon of clean water, and then shaking it in a specifically designed manner. Then a drop of that water goes through the same process, and so on, until science can no longer detect the active ingredient. Many homeopathic medicines go through dozens of dilutions, but some only go through two or three, and research has shown that these less aggressive dilutions still do contain small amounts of the original substance. Referring to a recent oncology study, the National Library of Medicine notes that some natural health products are sold as homeopathic agents, despite the fact that they do contain detectable levels of pharmacologically active ingredients. Quote, "A 2X or 3X solution in homeopathic terms could be pharmacologically active." All right, and that's it on this subject for now. Maybe. Well, that sure was some hopefully helpful information about avoiding poison ivy problems. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to replace my Roustox with 7-Up if I don't get out of this studio. Won't work, James. The bubbles will give it away. At any rate, we be out of time for today. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Follow the prompts to You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teaming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please, please, please include your location. And visit our Facebook page, where we are always posting new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, plus links to our priceless podcasts. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he pricked his finger on a spinning wheel while eating a poisoned apple and being yelled at by three evil sisters. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to my interviewers, Joey and Holly of the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. To learn more about their show, visit the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be studying the days to maturity ratings on seed packets to help me decide what to plant in my recently vacated garden beds, at least until I see you again next week.